Psycho Man. Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 433 of the Motorcycle Men podcast. And I got another interview for you for your listening pleasure. Hey, joining me today in the V-Twin Cafe is Dylan Code, and he is here to tell us all about the California Superbike School. But first, the Motorcycle Men podcast is brought to you by Scorpion Helmets. Now, they're offering high-quality, innovative motorcycle helmets and technical apparel at an incredible value. So to learn more, get on over to ScorpionUSA.com. Wild Ass Seats, you can improve your comfort and ability to stay in the saddle longer with a cushion from Wild Ass Seats. So if you're tired of those painful pressure points and fatigue, get on over to wild-ass.com and get your cushion from the real Craig Johnson today, and make sure you tell him that the Motorcycle Men podcast sent you on over. And of course, as always, Tobacco Motorwear for the best in casual riding gear for men and women. There is only one place you should be going, and that is Tobacco Motorwear. Visit them at tobaccomotorwear.com, and our listeners will get 10% off your order when you use the code MOTOMEN. Now, everyone here at the podcast is wearing Tobacco riding jeans and the California riding shirt. I'm using those Roper gloves. Wonderful stuff. I wear them for every ride. I won't ride without them. Now, your safety is worth it. So get on over to the Tobacco Motorwear and get in Dave's pants. You can also get this stuff from the Motorcycle Men website. That's right, boys and girls. Get on over to the shop at the Motorcycle Men website and get your goodies right there. That's right. Get your Tobacco Motorwear gear right from the Motorcycle Men website also. All right. Do it. All right. Time now for that interview with Dylan. Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 433, Motorcycle Men Podcast. Joining me today, all the way from, you're in California somewhere, right?
Exactly, Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Mr. Dylan Code. Dylan, welcome. How you doing?
Thank you. Very good. Doing really well.
Did I say your last name correct?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, just like it looks, C-O-D, code.
Okay.
It's apparently it's Irish.
Oh, I didn't know. So, yeah. Dylan, you run a real cool school, and why don't you just tell us who you are, your motorcycle self, and what you do.
Okay, so we basically, you could call me the COO of the California Superbike School, and in this case, it stands for Child of Owner. So my dad started the California. My dad started the California Superbike School in 1980, and he was a canyon racer, and then he went professional racing in the 70s and was very much a part of that whole movement of the superbike, where it went from super street class, and the club races are actually got national recognition, and then they started racing superbikes nationally in the AMA circuit. So it was an interesting and an exciting time for motorcycles in general. And my father did that for a while, and then 1980 decided to open up a school. He had been coaching people for rider training or coaching racers for a few years prior to that, but decided he wanted to open up a school. And at that point, it was what they call Blue Ocean. It basically, no one else did that. And I was very young at the time. I was only 10 years old, but the school started, and it really was just, it was called the California Superbike School, and the intention was just to do schools in California, but it caught on, and it ended up spreading nationally within a couple of years, and then actually internationally. So we've got branches all over the world. So right now we're the world's largest motorcycle track school since 1980. Yeah.
Holy crap. Really?
Yeah.
Damn. So when did the school officially start?
It was in the spring of 1980 at a track in Southern California, which isn't there anymore. It's called Riverside Raceway. And it's actually a fairly famous track in the early days. They had a lot of NASCAR races. And if for those of us who are a bit older, the Herbie, the Love Bug, some of those movies, there's shots of Riverside Raceway, but that's where the Can-Am cars and in the early 70s raced, and it had a lot of history. But it got, you know, just like any other track in a more popular area, it tends to get encroached on by civilization, and then it turned into a shopping mall.
As always, all the fun stuff. Is there a specific mission for the school?
I think really it's just providing a environment where people can improve their skills. If someone's riding on a public road and we were to try to figure out, okay, what percentage of their attention is on their technique, and then what percentage of their attention is on possible threats or dangers, whether that's things on the road or other motorists, etc. You know, it really depends on the scenario, but in some cases, only 90% of someone's attention is on what could happen, what are the possible threats, and maybe 10% on their own technique. And it really depends if it's an empty road, or you get the idea. But we kind of flip that when they're on the track. Everyone's going in the same direction. There's lots of runoff. You got corner workers looking out for you. And then you go to a school, and you've got some structure. You've gone through a classroom session just prior to that riding session, so you know what to pay attention to, and you got a coach riding there with you. So really, it's a super saturated learning period without all the distractions that you can get. And we try to minimize the risk. Riding motorcycles, we all know, is a dangerous activity, full stop. But if we can at least neutralize as many of those risks as possible, then we get the rider in an environment where they can actually make some really, really good progress on their own skills.
Sure. Now, would you say this is geared more towards the sport bike rider or anybody, actually?
That's originally where it was at, was more, you know, I want to ride sport bikes. I want to maybe go racing, but things have morphed to where it's your average rider. We get people that are just pure adventure riders, and you know, they've got their GS or whatever it is, and they come out to the school and they improve their cornering. I think everyone who's been riding a motorcycle for more than 5 minutes has gotten into a corner too hot and run wide and scared themselves. Yeah. And maybe not crashed as a result, and in some cases crashed. But we've all run into scenarios, or cornering scenarios, where we felt out of control, and we know that a better rider would have been fine. You know, there was something missing, but what was it? And when they come to a school, what ends up happening is you get a coach who's professionally trained, not someone that just comes and helps out on a volunteer basis, but actually a professionally trained coach with years of experience. And they're really good at looking at a rider and figuring out what the most major departure from the ideal is as far as their own riding skills. In other words, if we were to arbitrarily assess a rider on, let's say, 15 different core skills, they could pretty quickly assess which one is lower than the rest and then target that. And then we find that the rider really improves a lot across the boards when we find that one area that's dragging everything behind.
Okay. All right. So that's good. As far as it goes for your locations, the curriculum you had, which is pretty extensive, mm-hmm. How many locations do you have for that?
So we typically go to about a dozen places around the United States. And I guess that's a problem with the name California, because, yeah, we do schools in California, but we go all over the country. So it's going to be Virginia, Alabama to Barber Motorsports Park, New Jersey, Pittsburgh, the Ridge up in Washington. We got Northern California, Thunder Hill, Sonoma Raceway, Laguna Seca, world famous. And of course, in Southern California, we have the streets of Willow Springs. And we also go to Las Vegas. But then we've got branches in Australia. So we go to Australia, New Zealand. We go to Taiwan every year. We go to India every year. Sometimes Malaysia, sometimes Beijing, China, which was interesting when I went there, Thailand, we've been to Dubai a bunch, and then we've got a European branch which handles, basically, they're in England, so they'll do England and Norway and Poland and sometimes Greece and Bulgaria and places like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, geez, that's pretty like all over the place there.
Of
all your locations, which one sees the most activity?
As far as tracks, as attendance goes?
Yeah, sure.
I would say we schedule the most events in Southern California. So we could say that just because it's close to our home base at Willow Springs. But with that said, we run 8 days at New Jersey Motorsports Park, four in spring, four in the summer. So it's fairly evenly spread out, but just a little bit weighted towards Southern California. And there's a lot of people that ride in Southern California.
Okay. Now, the same curriculum that you have in California, that's the same that's taught everywhere, correct?
Right. Yeah. So we actually have had some people do level one in Australia and level two in England and then level three in the United States. So it's nice. There's continuity. We've got this thing.
Right.
Yeah, we've got this thing called a coach exchange program. So essentially what we do is we get coaches from different areas of the world, and it's like a student exchange. They will get the Australian ones to come to America, and American ones go to Europe, et cetera. But we're always rotating them so that we can get continuity.
And so I guess if somebody signs up in one location, they can say, you know what, I'm going to be in California next week. Let me just take the course there instead. Is that the kind of thing that happens? Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's nice to have that continuity as far as the schools go, and it's just kind of like a restaurant. You just want to make sure that the menu and the ingredients and the cooking procedures are going to be the same no matter where you go. Or you know, you want a Coca-Cola to taste like a Coca-Cola whether you're in Africa or Detroit.
Okay, yeah. Now, do you have? Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you run through us what's involved with each of your classes? Now, I can see by the curriculum, you have on-track coaching, the different levels, the single-day schools, the two-day camps. What's involved with each?
So you do one level per day. So someone comes, they just want to do one day with us, fine. Then they do level one. Level one mainly concerns itself with what you're doing with the controls, throttle, steering, relaxing the bars, things like that. And we also dip into visual skills. And then level two is more to do with visual skills. That's a deep dive into visual skills, body position related stuff, trail breaking. Level three is even more body position related stuff. And they don't really refer to how good or bad or fast or slow a rider is. It's just a package of the curriculum. And people move through one level per day. And they can do a deluxe two-day camp, which is a higher price point. It's about $3,000 for 2 days. And you get everything supplied. You get the motorcycle. You get all the gear if you need it. You just show up. You get a coach who's assigned to you. And they only have one other student for two whole days. So this is real, real intensive personalized coaching, which is it's economically, it's difficult to make that happen, but we do. And someone by the end of those 2 days has had a lot of very, very personalized attention. And it's the same person over 2 days. So it's not like random people are coming up to him, giving him tips. It's someone working with you the whole time. So it's really what we've found is needed to make a major, major change with a rider, because that's what most people are hoping for. And like I said, you know, riders go into corners and they encounter problems. They get scared from time to time. And they would like to not have that happen, or at least feel more in control of their motorcycle.
Sure. Now, as far as goes for, you get a new rider coming in, where should they start? Should they immediately start with the level one course, or opt for a two-day camp, or the single-day thing, or the on-track coaching? What's their starting point?
So basically there's two products. A single day school's inexpensive compared to the 2 day camp. So that's gonna be $850 if we supply the motorcycle, or $650 if you bring your own. And that's the single day school is one coach to three students. And you ride five classroom sessions and five riding sessions throughout the day. And everyone starts at level one. If you're a racer, you start at level one. If you are an intermediate rider, you start at level one. It doesn't, like I said, refer to how slow or quick you are. It's just that package of skills. And then someone may want to just try one day, right? And that's all their budget allows for. Fine, they do that. Or if they want something really deluxe, they said, okay, well, I've been away from riding and now I'm getting back into it. You know, the divorce is final. The kids are out of school. I want to do this. I want the best I can possibly get right now. I'm not fooling around with this. I don't want to hurt myself. I want as much personalized attention as possible. I say, okay, well, then do the two-day camp. And then they get that higher level of service. So there's really two price points, especially for someone who's not too sure. They can do the single-day school, or you can do like a poor man's two-day camp, which is two single-day schools together. And we get a lot of people that do that.
How many instructors do you have?
So at a school day, we have 23 staff.
Really?
of which 18 are instructors. Okay. So we're definitely not light on personnel. Yeah. And okay. The whole idea is to really make sure that when someone comes, they get well taken care of. Yeah. So, yeah, we've got a lot of staff.
No. Okay. What kind of bikes are you teaching everybody on if they don't bring their own bike?
So we partnered up with BMW. So we were with Kawasaki for 30 years, between 1980 and basically 2010.
Okay.
And when the global financial crisis hit, Kawasaki pulled a lot of their programs. They stopped road racing. They pulled back a lot of stuff. And it was right then that BMW had just come out with this new sport bike, which BMW up to that point was really your dad's or your grandpa's brand.
Yeah, pretty much.
All the boxer motors, mm-hmm. super reliable, and you know, a lot of, you know, you had that adventure element to it, or just people doing sport touring or touring. And then they came with a sport bike, which everyone's kind of going, what happened? Right? No one knew if it was going to be good or not. Mm-hmm. But we kind of took a gamble and said, hey, let's switch over to BMW, because Kawasaki wasn't able to support us. And a lot of the other brands were really worried about the economy. But BMW just launched this new bike, and they needed a platform to launch it. And we got this S1000RR, which is, you know, 180, 190 horsepower, quick shift, traction control, anti-lock brakes. It's pretty slick, especially at that time. And everyone was worried that the bike would get away from them. It would be too powerful. But it turned out the electronics were so mellow, you could dial it down to have any kind of attitude you wanted it to have. You want it to be a real mellow bike, you just put it in rain mode, and it's actually have a power output of something closer to, let's say, like a 650 twin.
Okay. Wow.
And then you can dial it up to be a fire breathing dragon however you want it. So it is actually really cool, and we're still like that, and a lot of the other brands make bikes just like that now too.
Wow. Do you
so anyway,
do you get a lot of people bring their own bikes?
We do, yes. It's probably around 20% bring their own bikes and 80% ride our bikes. And I think it's nice because, especially if they're traveling to, let's say, a destination place like Laguna Seca or Barber Motorsports Park, right. All they have to do is just hop on a plane. They don't even need to bring any gear with them because we have everything. They just show up and we take care of everything. So right. It's all turnkey. And that... Yeah, that has a certain appeal to certain people. They have busy lives. They're doing this, that, and the next. And they said, you know what? I want to just I just want to put my life on hold. I want to go out and I want to immerse myself in this experience and then go back. Yeah. And they can do that. They don't have to buy generators and awnings and tire warmers and stands. You know, they can just show up and do it and then leave, which is cool.
Yeah. Run. Tell you what. Run me through a typical day. Somebody coming in, level one, they show up. What happens?
They show up, they do registration, they grab some food, then we do a staff intro. Once the staff intro is done, then we do a safety briefing, then we split everyone off into their different levels. So if they're level one, then they stick around for the level one classroom. They'll get, like I said, a safety briefing from our course control. Then they get a technical briefing. Once that's done, they do an off-track exercise, which looks really closely at steering technique, which everyone who rides a motorcycle, they already know how to steer. But it's interesting about when it comes to steering, which is probably one of the most important skills, everyone's doing it perfectly. Plus they're doing about two or three things on top of that are unnecessary. They're additive. So we say, hey, doing it great, but there's this other thing you're doing, which you actually don't need to do. So it's more like taking things out of someone's backpack and throwing them away that they don't need for the camping trip, so to speak, right? So we call it sort of a subtractive action. Yeah. We end up taking, whether the person's tensing up or pushing the bike away from them or pressing on the bars and then holding or pressing and counter-pressing, things like that. But we have a close look at them. Anyway, they do that. Then they go out for their first session. Their coach rides with them. They lead them. They follow them. Then when the session's over, it's about a 20-minute session, they get debriefed from their coach. Then they get sent back into the classroom for the next briefing. Then they take a little bit of a break, about 20-minute break, so they can chill out, cool off or whatever. Then they go back out on track, and that repeats itself five times throughout the day. That's for the single day school. If it's a 2 day camp, it'll be seven times.
Oh, wow. Now, what time does this start in the morning, and what time do you finish up at the end of the day?
Around 7 a.m. to 5 p.m.
No way. Really?
Yeah.
That's a long day. And I assume you break for lunch at some point.
Exactly. It's a real immersion, and it's kind of cool because the vibe is a little different than, let's say, a track day. A track day is, I wouldn't say tribal, but you go to track day, everyone pays their money, and they get to go out into the playground and play.
Yeah.
And as long as you're behaving yourself, you're fine. But what you're working on and what happens out there is what happens out there. And it's kind of cool because it's rather permissive. And sometimes riders, they want that. But then when you go to a school, everyone's going, all right, I came here to learn. I came here to be a better rider. And you've got coaches out there that are working with you. They're giving you constant feedback. Right. And everyone has this general vibe of, you know, I want to improve as a rider. So that competitive element isn't as prominent as what could develop. And it's interesting. I mean, people really start to form bonds that, you know, wouldn't normally talk to each other. And we've had a lot of people strike lifetime friendships with other people they met at the school. But it's a really nice community. If you want to be on your own and not be, you know, stuck to other people, it's that's totally fine as well. It's just there are plenty of like-minded people there for you to meet if you want. And it's really nice to be able to provide that environment along with, you know, a really cool riding experience. And I think more and more with social media brings us so close to people, but so far away. It's almost like talking to someone on the other side of a wall, right? You can hear them, but you can't see. It's, you know what I mean? And I think when someone goes to a school and they meet not like-minded people, it's a really refreshing thing, because I think human beings evolved, or many people said they evolved to be tribal, you know, tribe, sure, you know, maybe around 150 fairly close contacts. And what ends up happening is you end up getting a very small amount of really close contacts and a huge amount of really superficial ones. So it's also got this really cool community element to it.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. Wow. Now, how many students or riders do you get per year? Or per location?
In the United States, it's around 2,500 to 2,700 students per year. And then the foreign branches is going to be maybe about 2,000, another 2,000 per year spread across those. Yeah.
Of all your locations, which ones, I guess California would be your busiest then?
I would say so. I mean, when we go back east, you've got, let's say it's in the Northeast, so you've got your winter time where no one's going to do any riding. So we hit them in their spring and summer, but we avoid the other times of the year just because of the weather. Yeah. And then like Las Vegas, we go there in the fall and the spring for obvious reasons. And that works out really well.
Wow. It is interesting. What's the balance of men and women that take classes there?
So last I heard, about 14% of the new motorcycle buyers are women, but I don't think we're quite there as far as students go. I think we're probably in the mid single digits, you know, maybe 6-8% women. And I'd definitely like to change that, but we do get women on a steady basis. But I have a feeling that there might be just some sort of perception that we need to overcome in order to get more doing that, coming to a track school. And I don't know exactly what it is, because when you're, if you're looking at a quote unquote woman rider, they're so diverse that you can't just say, okay, this is how we capture the quote unquote women riders, because they've got different reasons for doing it. And some of them are lone wolves. Some of them are part of a big group, et cetera, et cetera. But we have been getting women ever since, you know, actually at the very, very beginning, we got almost no women in the early 80s. And then that started to ramp up. Yeah. But, you know, we even did women-only schools. But now we just kind of look at them as riders. And if they happen to be a female, then they happen to be a female. But it's kind of, it, it's it's sort of blending in. It's just another human. I joke that there are only two genders, writers and non-writers.
Exactly.
I wonder what it is that makes women not want to, or is it just not having the interest in that kind of writing? I don't know.
Someone said there's like logistics and making it out, just not really sure what the environment is going to be. Like what's going to actually happen when I get there? Am I going to be beyond my depth, et cetera, et cetera. But that's, again, that's just a certain percentage. But I think as time goes by, more women come and then they say, oh, no, it's not like that. You get along just fine. Yeah. I think that once we get the women riders, as far as a percentage to the number of women riders that are buying new bikes, then I say that we're doing our job right as far as making ourselves available.
Yeah. Is that just an area of just marketing to get more women in there? Or?
I don't know. It's one of these things where it's not like a quote unquote problem, but it also just might have to be looked at as like, well, why exactly do you ride motorcycles? And then try and align it to that.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Hey, would you say that your courses might be a springboard to professional racing?
Well, our graduates have actually gone on to win 107 world and national championships.
Oh, really?
So, and, you know, we were more on the racing side in the early days, like in the 80s and 90s, but we've pivoted more to just your everyday rider, you know, someone who perhaps just commutes to work and then maybe rides on the weekends, that type of thing, or your adventure rider, your sport tour. But there are some people that come to the school because we do have a long history of training people who win, and not just win, they win championships and, you know, and world championships, and they're winning world level races, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not something we really concentrate on. These people just come to us and we train them, but we don't really solicit like, hey, you want to be a great racer? Come see us. Yeah. But we will. And I'll work with young riders. When I was young, I used to race and I got a lot of support. I wouldn't say it was overwhelming. It was almost overwhelming how people were just so generous, you know. Oh, you want to race? You want to race my bike? Yeah, no problem. Here you go. And it was sort of like, what do I have to do? Nope. Just want to see a kid do well. And I didn't really understand it when I was a kid. Why are people just so friendly and letting it with no strings attached, no nothing? Just I'll show up. Yeah, there's the bike, and then at the end of it, then you leave, you never see the person again. They don't ask for anything in return. It was just like, hey, no big deal, right? So that's what I do. When there are young racers who are putting an effort in, it's kind of like I have to pay it forward. You know, you get a young racer and you can tell that their family's all in, and then I'll say, hey, you want to come out and ride on the track? You can do that. And, oh, Dylan, do you need us to do anything for you? Do you want us to tag you on social media? I don't care. It's just no big deal. It's just, I'm just, you know, giving back the way that was given to me. And if it works out for you, that's great. But it takes a village, and I know that. So, you know, this whole thing of racing, especially youth racing, it's incredibly competitive. And like I said, it takes a village. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. 80% of the equation is the parent.
Yeah.
It's the parent. They invest so much in it. And I'm always happy to help.
What's the youngest you've ever had come to your class?
Well, we did a kids' school, and it was really fun. There were 20 kids, and they were, I think, between the ages of 4 and 10.
Wow, so and, those micro bikes out there, huh?
Yeah. We did it at a go-kart track, and all these kids showed up with their parents, and it was kept under control. It didn't get out of control. I mean, a lot of kids already race. So it was through a racing organization, a mini racing organization. And we got all the kids and we did our level one curriculum with them. And normally that takes one day, but we did 2 days with them. And a lot of it, we went through a lot of the kinesthetics. You know, we'd have the kids move their hands and so on and describe what they're going to do when they went on track, just to try and make sure that they understood what we were asking them to do. And it was really fun. And when you get kids together, it's a real riot, especially at the end of the day when they're done riding. Yeah. They all just want to be kids. They're all running around on mounds of dirt and falling all over each other and screaming. And it's pretty fun. But yes, we have trained plenty of kids on the big track. Probably the youngest kid we had on a big track was maybe 10 or 11.
Wow.
Really? And we, you know, insurance wise, it's hard to do that. They have to already have a racing license. So if they've been racing on minis, then we can get insurance for them because they've already proven themselves. They know what they're doing.
That's really cool. Have you ever had like one of these kids come in and specifically say, I'm doing this because I want to be a professional racer?
Yeah. Some of these kids they're dead set, and they know how dangerous it is, and they're going to know some kids that have gotten in bad accidents and some that have even died doing it. And you can't really ignore that. You have to say, hey, look, you know, this can happen. And then there's all these social issues and attitudes connected to stuff like that, and I don't really try to steer that narrative just because it's so personal. Yeah. But these kids know it, and they are dead set. Like this is it. Everything else is absolutely boring. I remember when I was a younger kid, when I was racing, and I go to school and kids are bouncing the basketballs around or they're interested in whatever track and field sports. And I'm just looking at that going, like, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
It is just so boring. Like, just, you know, shoot me in the head, man. This is absolutely the worst thing. And I would do it for exercise or just to hang out with the friends and be social. But it was certainly not anything I was interested in.
There's a different level of adrenaline going on there.
Yeah, and I think when you get on a motorcycle and you put a bike into a corner at 110 miles an hour, that transforms you. It puts you in a mental state that is really unrivaled in most sports. And I talk about this from time to time. And I think every motorcyclist knows this. When you're on a twisty road, okay, let's say we're not on the track, you're on a twisty road, and it's one of these really great twisty roads where the corners are all linked. You know, there's not too many straightaways. In other words, that you don't have much time to take a mental break.
Yeah.
You have to watch each corner as it comes up and unfolds and reveals more of itself to you. And you've got a pace that's not frightening, but it definitely demands your undivided attention. And there you are for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes in this quasi-meditative state. And you compare that to anything else people do on a daily basis and say, how often is someone thrust into a situation where they have to have absolute unbroken concentration on something that also happens to be rewarding and fun? And when you think about it, there are definitely things like that, but not many. And I ask groups, I say, so, you know, where do you get into a scenario where you have to have unbroken attention? And I actually posed it on an open forum somewhere, and someone said, well, you know, as a surgeon, you know, they open the body up and they need to work on it. But that's not necessarily fun. Right? It doesn't have like sensation and all that type of thing. And you're not really,
it's life and death,
you
don't, for sure.
Yeah, it's life and death, but it's a little bit more critical.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that playful element to it.
Of course.
Or that romantic element. And then someone also said, being a trial lawyer, if someone's a trial lawyer, I mean, they have to be turned on the whole time and paying attention to everything that's occurring. But the closest thing I can think of is probably downhill mountain biking. You know, the top of that run, and you have to be turned on the whole time. But in most sports, you've got these bursts, and then, you know, there's a foul in basketball, and then there's a free throw, or there are the plays. And then, of course, in hockey, you know, they're out on the ice, and then they jump off the ice, and then the other people come out of the box. Yeah, well, but how often is someone thrust into something that's fun, it's interesting, and it demands your undivided? So it's a real meditative, you know, like amazing mental state that people are in. And I think kids realize this pretty early on, and it's really enriching on some kind of basic level.
You know, because it's the different levels of focus you have with each activity. And certainly something like motorcycling, you know, mountain biking, as you said, there's a level of focus that you're holding for not just mere seconds, but you're holding it for minutes, long
right.
minutes, and which I think it helps with that adrenaline rush, of course.
Yeah, I remember going sporting clays. You know, there you are with a shotgun, and then, okay, we're about to, you know, get the clay pigeon sent, and then you go into this mode of pure concentration, pull, pow, pow, right? But then it's over.
Yeah.
But it's really cool to get into that absolute concentrated state, but when it's continuous, it's fabulous. It's really fabulous.
Track. Of course, it depends on the track, of course.
Yeah, if it's really short, it's going to be typically just a little over a minute. If it's really long, it's going to be 2.5-3 minutes, depending on how fast the rider is.
Yeah. And we're talking about speeds very fast.
Yeah, I mean, if someone's got the nerve, yeah. I mean, it depends on the tracks. I mean, usually the thing about tracks is, even if you have long straightaways, you end up running out of room.
Yeah.
Because, like the back straight at Circuit of the Americas, you know, we've done schools there in the past. You come out of a first gear corner, and then let's say you're on a 1,000cc bike, you hold the throttle wide open, you go from first to second to third to fourth, and in most cases, you can't even get into sixth gear because you run out of space.
Wow.
But by the time you're in, you know, deep into fifth gear, you're doing like almost a football field a second.
That's just crazy. Holy
crap. Yeah, which sounds really reckless, but bikes at that speed are super stable.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They just want to keep going straight.
You know, there comes really fast at you.
It does, yeah. And you know, the equations of energy, the energy doesn't double when you double the speed. It goes up. I think it's 4x the energy. So things really change. And yeah, when you are dealing with big numbers like that, what you think is possible is, you know, like a stopping distance, really good stopping distance from 60 miles an hour. You know, after someone's recognized, they're going to stop and they apply the brakes. It's going to be about 120 feet. That's a really good stopping distance, right? Yeah. But if we just add 40 miles an hour to that, we go to 100 miles an hour, then it gets to like 400 feet, 430 feet.
That's crazy.
So
into a turn right away.
yeah. So anyway, there's lots of cool things that make it a game. And I think that's why people like to go to school, is because there are certain parts of it where you can master pretty easily. And there's other parts that can really become a conundrum to the rider. But when they do overcome them, it's just this amazing feeling of accomplishment. And it's just sort of a new level of control.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we provide. That's what we sell.
Wow. What's the oldest rider you've ever had?
Mid 80s.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How'd they die?
Mid 80s. You know, we got this older guy. He's an outlier, right? I think he's in his early 80s, and he's fast too. And everyone's so worried about him because if he were to go down or even just tip over in the parking lot, you don't know what's going to happen, right? So we make sure that he has an air vest and all that type of thing. But he's like, yeah, I don't care. I'm going, and he rides really fast, and everyone's always trying to reel him in, like, okay, you're going really quick now. Let's just try and, like, just back it down a little bit. He's like, okay, what am I doing wrong? So not that many things, but we just want to make sure that you're
having fun. Leave me alone. Good for him, right? Yeah, hey.
Exactly.
He's living life, man.
That's and you can't – this is something, you know, when it comes to motorcycles, you can't really – you know, life's lived by many people, and they all have their reasons. Yeah. And you can't thrust your standards on somebody else. And it's interesting, you know, we're a motorcycle school. So, of course, as the motorcycle industry does better, if the motorcycle industry is thriving, then that should also trickle down to us. But I look at riding as really a personal choice. And it's not my goal to grow the sport.
Right.
It's like I'm giving clean needles to junkies, right? If you have made that decision, then we will make it as safe as possible for you. But I'm not running around telling people, yeah, you should go ride motorcycles. It's great, because there is a level of danger connected to it, and it's not for everyone.
Right.
But so when people come to us, they've already signed up. And we're saying, okay, great. So here we are.
Yeah.
This is a fantastic activity. And part of it, what makes it so fantastic, is it's dangerous. Because if it wasn't dangerous, then it wouldn't be as thrilling. It wouldn't demand your undivided attention. It wouldn't be so meditative. It's like this sort of paradox that we operate with.
So it's skydiving.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I have an interesting skydiving story. I thought, you know, I was much younger. I said, yeah, I want to try skydiving. Well, I know that there's this tandem jumps that you can do, so I'll sign up for that. So I just look up, you know, skydiving, go to a place, and we go up in the plane, and we get, you know, we're connected, and then we jump out of the plane, we free fall, and then open up the chute, and you feel that, you know, big G-force, we're slowing down. Oh, this is kind of cool. And then the guy says, yeah, our canopy is a little tangled. I'm going to untangle it. And so he untangles it. And we continue down. We land. And that was cool. But I was like, oh, we had a little bit of a minor malfunction, but it was no big deal. So I was like, okay, let's do another one. So some months later, I go on another one. And it's just another tandem jump. I don't really have a whole lot of time. I'm busy. And you don't have the money to go do all the training, et cetera, to get into it myself, but I definitely wanted to do it again. So we jump out. This is at a different provider. We jump out. We're free falling. He says, pull the cord. So I pull the cord, and then we don't really get that same G-force. And, you know, because it just didn't feel like the first time when the chute deploys, you really feel like you're not even slowing down. It feels like you're going up.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So then the guy says, we're going into emergency procedure. Hold this. So he pulls all this. It's like this long metal cord, mm-hmm. hands it to me. And then I think we're at 5,000 feet at that point. And then he kicks the main chute. So we go back into free fall at 5,000 feet.
Oh, no.
And at that point, when he said we're going to emergency procedure, I kept my mouth shut. I was not going to say, hey, wait, tell me what's going on. You know, I just kept my mouth shut. And we went back into free fall. And he says, okay, I'll pull this one. So he pulls, and then the spare chute deploys and properly. Although we come down a little quicker.
Yeah.
So only thing I said is, which way do you want to roll? He says, to our left. And okay, fine. So then we land, roll, and everything's fine. But people on the ground saw that we had to jettison, cut loose the main chute.
Yeah.
And so they were a bit kind of spooked looking. And I made it to the ground. But I said, you know, is this some sort of message I'm getting? The first jump had a malfunction. The second one, we needed to use the spare. So anyway, I haven't done any more skydiving since then.
Right?
I guess. I mean, I'm not, you know, I could probably do it again, but I'd want to do the whole thing where you know, you get properly trained so you can just do it yourself.
Yeah. Wow. So let's not do that anymore.
Right.
I have to assume you visited most of, if not all of the locations.
Most of, yes.
Yeah.
I've been to a lot of tracks around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And also around the world. I think I've been to, I think it's like, we've been to 17 different countries and I don't know, 50 or 60 different tracks. I forget. But yeah, been around. It's really cool going international because you get a lot of, it's, if you go to the Middle East, for example, you've got a lot of kindred souls you don't know about.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that just love riding motorcycles, and we've got our differences and beliefs and ways of life, et cetera, et cetera. And But when it comes to motorcycling, no one wants to talk about the differences. They want to just talk about,
it's all about
bikes.
Motorcycles.
Yeah, and it's really nice when that happens, whether someone's from Africa or South Africa or, you know, the Middle East or in Asia. It's really cool to just be able to jump right into that group and you know, just see that you've got so many things in common. It's really cool.
Wow. Do you have a favorite track?
I have different favorite tracks for different reasons. One of them that really stands out every time is Phillip Island in Australia. It's just a beautiful track on an island, of course, and you're coming up the front straightaway, and it climbs slowly, and then it crests, and then it descends slowly. But when it crests, you see just this roaring, almost like it's, I guess that's the way, roaring visual of the ocean, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. That tracks with the ocean in the background are not common.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fascinating. And the track's really fun and it's flowy, etc. And then just in Australia, it's a chill country. It's at least, you know, where we go.
Yeah.
And the only thing that beats Australia as far as being chill is New Zealand. That's about as good as it gets.
Wow. What's the do you have a least favorite track?
Least favorite track.
If there is such a thing.
We don't go there anymore.
That's right.
We don't go there anymore. But you know, a track is a track, and even if the track is small and bumpy and not that great, if you're riding really well, it's fun.
Yeah, of course.
In other words, someone says, "Hey, what's your favorite track?" And the answer is the one where I'm riding the best. Even if it's a track that just is uninspiring for one reason or another, if you're riding really well, it's fun. It's great. I mean, if you get someone just doing figure eights in a parking lot and the technique is really on point, it feels great. So you can have fun. It's, someone say, what bike do you prefer to ride? And I'm like, oh, okay, well, it depends on the application. But, you know, whether it's a little push scooter or a motorized scooter or an adventure bike or a dirt bike, it's just two wheels or a gravel bike or a mountain bike. I love it all.
Yeah,
so
you can have fun in a parking lot, for God's sakes, if you're doing it.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
What's the longest track you guys do?
Right now, the longest track, I believe, is Pittsburgh.
Really?
And that's 3 miles. Nice. That was a shorter track. And then there was a group of, I don't know exactly the details, but what it seems like, there's a group of people who had the financial means to A, purchase a track, and B, upgrade it.
Okay.
So that's what happened. So it basically got doubled in length. And right now it's my favorite track in the United States, Pittsburgh. They call it Pit Race. And fantastic track. Beautiful, you know, out in the country. Mm-hmm. So, and that's about 3 miles, and it's just tons and tons of fun.
That's nice. Hey, how can people learn more about California Superbike School?
You just go to superbikeschool.com, and that's our website, and we're on social media and that type of thing. And if people have questions and they pose them on, let's say, our Ask Us, you know, when you go to a website and there's contact us, we actually look at those and respond in a timely fashion or on social media. But those are the key ways. Right. And you just check it out. And really what you want to do is look at the schedule. It tells you when, where, and how much. That's usually what people want to know.
Right.
But if they're worried about whether or not they're going to get well taken care of or if it's beyond their depth, unless you just learned how to ride a motorcycle and you're still kind of fumbling with the controls, you'll be fine. But if you're still just learning how to use the controls and how to get around and you know, you're petrified to go on the freeway and you have a hard time even just making it to the store and back, I'd say, all right, well, get some more basic training, and then once you're at least at that first level of okay, I can get around well, then come see us, and we can definitely make people better in a very short period of time.
Well, it sounds to me like you take care of all of your students who come there who want to learn something new, or a certain learn period. So there's no question about that. Any closing words to those out there who might want to get more serious about their superbike riding?
Well, the schools exist. I guess really the main point is there's a technology to riding. We've spent a lot of time slicing it, dicing it, dissecting it, figuring out ways to impart it in a way that people can have perhaps maybe even a bit of a complicated or complex technique or idea explained, and they can grasp it, they can go out, they can find actual observable, measurable improvement. So there really is a technique or an art to writing, and it can be taught, it can be learned, and writers can exceed their own expectations as far as levels of competence and control. And that's really what we're looking for, is we're looking for that person at the end of the day who goes, wow, I had high expectations, but I had no idea it was going to be like this. I should have done this a long time ago, et cetera, et cetera. And we go, yeah, well, that's great. You're here now. But there's definitely a technology and a technique to it. And even if you've been writing for many, many years, we can help you with those little areas that are weak compared to everything else. And it's a ton of fun when you do make those big breakthroughs.
Absolutely. All right, Dylan, listen, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, learn more about the school and all the courses that you're offering. So don't go anywhere. I want to talk to you when we're done, but thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
The Motorcycle Men podcast is supporting David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. Now, if you would like to help and be a part of something that actually makes a difference, donate today to David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. Go to davidsdreamandbelieve.org to donate. Links will be in the show notes. And, of course, the Gold Star Ride Foundation. We're helping families of fallen soldiers and making a difference in the lives of those left behind. So if you'd like to be a part of a great cause and get some heartfelt miles in, go to goldstarride.org and learn how you can participate in the next Gold Star Ride. Hey, we're helping long-haul Paul Pelin complete his mission to ride 1 million miles for MS. Now, he was told years ago that a cure for MS was 1 million miles away. So he decided to ride that 1 million miles for that cure. You can help him by going on over to longhaulpaul.com and donate to his quest for that cure for MS. Hey, thanks for joining me and Dylan from the California Superbike School here in the V-Twin Cafe, where he told us all about the school and the courses and everything that they offer. You can learn more about the school by getting on over to www.superbikeschool.com. Links will be in the show notes and, of course, on the Motorcycle Men website at motomenpc.com. Hey, don't forget to get over to the Ride with Ted YouTube channel and watch some of the many videos I have there. More coming. It's been super ungodly hot here in North Carolina, so I haven't really been doing too much riding, and I've been very busy. So, but get on over there. New videos are coming, and if you'll please like and subscribe, that'd be a tremendous help to the channel. Of course, it does help the podcast. Hey, get your copy of my book, The Road Most Traveled. Now you can get it direct right from me on the Motorcycle Men website and save nearly $8. Of course, it's still available on Amazon, but you can still get it from me, and if you want, I can even sign it for you. So go over to motomenpc.com and hit the shop, and you'll see it right there. All right, kids, for the rest of the Motorcycle Men team, thanks for listening, and remember, we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Ride safely, kids.